That's me on the podcast, sharing a song with something to say about it. With Thin Lear and Niagara Moon, losing my opinion.
So guys, I saw Furiosa this past weekend. Mad Max Saga.
Okay, this is our opening? This is the...
Yeah, it's our opening. You got a problem with it?
Go ahead, please.
That's a movie, correct?
You guys like movies, right?
Yeah, I'm a big movie guy.
I have been known to see them from time to time.
Are you Mad Max fans, either
it's
of you?
All right. It's fine.
I haven't seen one since Mel Gibson.
Well, all right, you got to see Fury Road. And if you like Fury Road, Furiosa is definitely also worth checking out. It was good. It was solid. I couldn't help but notice when we went, though... I guess it's been a news item recently. The theater was mostly empty, and it was like Memorial Day weekend. It was a rainy day. If that's not a perfect day for the theater to fill up to see Blockbuster, I don't know what is. And it was just, it was pretty sparsely attended. And I'm thinking if we're seeing this with huge Blockbuster movies, if Frank Miller can't bring in audiences, you know, the next time you play a live show and you don't get too many guests... similar phenomenon. Can we take this reasoning and move it over to indie live music shows?
I think we got to combine it. I was actually thinking of screening Dune 2 behind me at the next show I play and seeing if I can get some
with the sound on.
There you go. It's
that's a good question.
Audience plus movie audience, just put them together for the same event and you get one whole
maybe
audience.
With the sound off. You're right, Adam. I need to.
When I was 16 years old, I played this place called Don Hills in like lower Manhattan. And the entire show, they had Pink Flamingos playing on loop.
Oh, that's crazy.
I was 16, and it was the first time I'd ever seen a man's asshole whistle.
Sure.
It's or
distracting.
How about that ending scene with Divine picking up,
Dear God.
Great stuff.
Well, you had to pay to play back then.
That's true. That was the payment, was having to focus while watching that. Well... you may have noticed the third voice today on the show. You might recognize it as Adam Kasten, who is, I guess, first and foremost, one of the most interesting human beings that has ever come from Long Island.
Oh, Matt.
I'd say top five.
Hey, he said from Long Island. That narrows it down.
I guess. I mean, he's in there with like Lou Reed and stuff in terms of most interesting pound for pound Long
Whoa,
Islanders.
Come on. But there's Billy Joel. There's...
But Billy Joel's not
Bill
interesting.
Bill O'Reilly.
Other people.
Billy Baldwin.
Billy Baldwin's a little interesting. I don't think Bill O'Reilly's interesting. I think you kind of suss him out pretty easily. Anyway, founding member of Color Book, an amazing band that you should listen to if you have not listened to their work. You should go check them out. And current member of Ouija, who you should also check out. And I believe they are actively playing shows now, which we will plug later on. But definitely go listen. Everything he's involved in, no matter what it is always worth listening to and enjoying. We have Adam Kasten with us. Thank you for being here again.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you for that. Oh, my God. What an introduction.
Well, thanks for introducing the guest, Matt. I guess we should also introduce ourselves, introduce the show. This is, of course, Losing My Opinion, the one, the only music opinion conspiracy theory podcast.
The only music podcast.
I am poor excuses generating Baroque pop indie artist Niagara Moon, a.k.a. Thomas
poor
Irwin.
Poor excuses generating? What the hell am I going to do with that? I am totally justified indie musician Thin Lear, a.k.a. Matt Longo.
And we're here today to talk some tunes, share crazy things with each other. Nobody else has any idea what to expect. We'll dive in, shall we?
Let's do it.
I got something to talk about.
Is it funny or boring?
I think it's good.
Okay.
I think it's good stuff.
The only two possible outcomes.
It's a direct response, sort of a direct response to last week. You brought in Tool.
I tried to get Thomas into Tool. Oh, man, did I fail. Oh, my goodness.
Was he not having it?
I love Tool, but I'm not like, there are real Tool fans out there. I am not one of them. I just, you know, I like some of their albums, but he hated it.
I've known you for so many years. I did not know you were a Tool fan in any sense.
Big fan of Danny Carey. Love that drumming. Yeah.
It is, you know, it's a very particular sound. There's not much else that sounds exactly like it, you know?
There isn't.
So they have that going for them.
I want to clarify again, I don't have an issue with Tool. I respect to Tool and to Tool fans. I don't have a problem with them. I can't handle metal.
Not at all.
It's not for me. I can't do metal. There is a sound in metal, and certainly I heard it in Tool, and hopefully I would think you guys would agree on this. There is an anger. There's like an inconsolable anger to that sound, right?
Absolutely.
I don't have that. I feel like they're angry at me. It's like, I'm like, all right, guys, I'm sorry. Like anything with metal, Tool, I don't care. Iron Maiden, Mastodon, Metallica. It's like, oh, okay, all right. Like that's going to be my response.
But it's usually very nerdy lyrical content. Like usually singing about like witches and like Lord of the Rings.
Even those like Nazi black metal bands are singing about Lord of the Rings and shit. It's yeah. All the time. But no metal. That's so wild. What about punk music? Do you listen to like more on the cerebral side of punk, the kinds of
punk's a little more open. I feel like punk is almost more like an ideology than a certain like sonic arrangement.
Sure.
I would say like punk to me can often be like youthful energy. It's not like metal. The energy of metal and Tool is like, oh my god, fuck you, believe the, what the fuck, guys, like that's what I hear every time you put on one of those songs, and I just hit that wall. Yeah. So I just wanted to set the record straight there.
There's something about like down-tuned guitars and low-tuned drums and the sort of, I don't know, the songs are very meandering for me. When I listen to it, it feels that way. Mm. I've never been a Tool fan. I do like some metal, though. You know, there's some very cool stuff out there. And some of it, you know, I'm always looking for things that are kind of psychedelic. So when it sort of hits that pulse, it never hit it for me like that, though. Tool always made me feel like going to sleep. And that's what my issue with them was.
Jeez. Thomas likes Suicide, though, which I thought was interesting, because I think of them as
angry-sounding.
That's like
punky electronica. That's not metal, you know? Anyway, we're getting off topic. All to say, I have trouble with metal. That was my problem with Tool. I can enjoy Prague.
Oh, yeah.
The other ingredient in Tool's recipe, I would argue.
Boy.
Emerson, Lake, and Palmer?
I don't like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. We established that very early on.
Not even Love Beach?
Not even. That's exactly what I was going to say. Not even Love Beach? Oh, my God.
Can't do it.
Not even?
But I do like Prague, and I want to talk about Prague today.
Oh, yes.
Here's what happened. You know, we rolled out a Losing My Opinion survey, which I will do again today. I'm going to put a link to the survey in the in the show notes. Just a few quick questions for any fans out there who want to, you know, share anything about themselves, ideas, or thoughts they have about the show. I'm posting it again. Would love to hear from more people. Somebody a while back, a listener named Kevin.
Hey, Kevin.
One of their episode ideas was prog rock for people who hate prog rock.
That's a great idea.
It's a great idea.
Fantastic.
I don't know why it took me over 6 months to respond to that. Sorry, Kevin. I hope you're still listening. And sorry to others who've offered ideas. There's a lot of good stuff in there. We'll sift through it in time. But I wanted to take ownership of that today, coming off of our Tool episode. I wanted to dig into Prague proper today.
Are you, and I hate to immediately be hostile. I don't mean this in a
hostile
way.
I do it all the time.
Way. It's going to sound hostile. Do you feel qualified to have this conversation? I've not thought of you as a Prague man before.
You are
Prague
right.
Hog.
A Prague
hog. You are right to question my Prague credentials. I am not the biggest Prague fan. I'm very much a fair weather progressive rock fan, and that's a big part of why maybe I held off on this topic for so long. Upon further reflection, though, I do feel I am qualified to answer this question, Prague rock for people who hate Prague rock.
That might
because I can understand. Yeah. I understand that perspective. I know that type of listener. I'd like to think I can be that type of person. There are things about Prague I don't care for and try to avoid. I go for the cream of the crop, generally speaking. So that is what I'm focusing on today.
Okay.
I'm a very basic Prague fan, but maybe that's what the assignment calls for.
It's worth remembering that there was a time in this country where Prague records were number one on the charts. And that,
crazy.
Yeah. Like, you know, a span of like 5 years where people were really digging it.
Wizards and whatnot.
Yeah.
It's good that we have Adam on the show today because I remember as soon as you started talking about this, I remembered us having a long conversation about Gentle Giant at some point in our friendship, which I love that we have that history.
Yeah, man.
Yes.
Well, literally nobody else to talk to about.
That's the problem. Prog fans often have that problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't checked out Gentle Giant. The names always come up, but would you recommend a particular record by them?
Octopus in a Glass House. Those two are really, really cool. In a Glass House, particularly. I think that one is great.
I'm always open to further prog suggestions. It's unlike metal, I don't just like put a wall up. Like it can offer me cool things sometimes.
Yeah, a lot of triplets. A lot of 16th note triplets.
I mean, there's progressive rock. That's a huge, you know, generalization.
Yeah.
You're trying to contain a lot of different music with that term. I feel like primo prog rock, that like, you know, what's going to pop into most people's heads. And sometimes I struggle with these qualities of stuff like very fiddly time signatures. Oh, it's 17/8 over here. Oh, for this little fill, it's 8/6. Oh, now we're going in this section where it's trip. You know, it's fiddly with the rhythm. Am I correct on that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sometimes I like that. Sometimes it's like, chill out, guys. Like, I can't follow the logic of this. So that's sometimes an issue I have. This mainly pertains to 70s era prog rock, but maybe going into the 2000s. If you got a chintzy synthesizer tone, I struggle with that. Again, I'm looking at you, Keith Emerson.
Yeah.
I love synth so much. Some of Emerson, Lake and Palmer stuff has cool synth sounds. Some of it has very silly, very farty noises.
Yeah.
That I could do without, which...
Mm-hmm. I own several synthesizers myself. A well-used synthesizer I love, but if it gets to, you know what I'm talking about. Like, I don't go for that.
Yeah, I'm just thinking Carnival 9 and my hatred of that song.
Step inside, step inside.
What? Oh, man, his lyrics. We could talk about that another time, but his lyrics are so funny.
Well, that's another part of it, right? I mean, prog lyrics are typically either, like, willfully confounding.
Yeah.
Or if you can understand it, it's about, like, you know, wizards and Lord of the Rings type.
What's that? Still You Turn Me On? He's got this line where he's, somebody get me a ladder. It's like, it's unrelated to everything else. Somebody
to
get
what?
So they I think they named a tour Someone Get Me a Ladder Tour or some shit like that. Because I think to some extent the lyrics are just jumbles of stuff. Tolkien and
confusing.
Sometimes they sort of add in like a popish kind of love song.
Eastern philosophy sometimes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Tales from Topographic Oceans. I don't know what the fuck that means, really.
See, that I'm okay with, because as I've said a few times now, I'm a musics guy. I'm not really a lyrics guy. If the lyrics are totally impenetrable to me, I don't really care that much if I like the music that's going on. Which leads me into the first band I want to talk about, because I'm basic. I want to talk about Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, they're squarely in the prog realm. I think they're more towards like commercial prog, like near like ELO or whatever. Like they're sort of, but Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Prog rock for people who hate prog. So we're staying very commercial here. I'm not getting too obscure. I'm a basic prog fan. I love me some Yes. Basically, the answer to Kevin's prompt here could just be like the first few Yes albums. Like if that's all you ever hear of prog rock, like that's pretty good. You did pretty well there. Close to the Edge, come on. The Yes album.
They could write songs. They could. They had that.
Solid hooks.
Mm. Yeah.
And undeniable musicianship, obviously. That rhythm section, oh my God.
Holy shit.
Chris Squire, right? That's the bassist name. Like, what? Jesus Christ.
Bill Bruford? One of them.
Bruford, I
tripped
think.
Him once in a jazz club in New York City.
Intentionally?
I was on a cell phone, and it's 2006 or something. I went to see his jazz band, Earthworks, and I was sitting in the back where I shouldn't have been, and he came running to get something, and he tripped over my foot. It was embarrassing. It was very, very embarrassing.
Did you do it on purpose?
Yeah, of
course.
You
can tell us here.
The statute of limitations has run out on that. Could have broken his fucking leg or something. Oh, my God.
That's good stuff. Bill Bruford's great.
If you're listening, Bill, sorry about that.
Sorry about that, Bill.
Yeah, sorry, Bill. Jesus.
Love your drumming, Bill. So let's start. Again, I'm not reinventing the wheel. We're going to go to Fragile, 1971. Classic Yes album. It's got all the hits. I want to play some Long Distance Runaround.
Yeah, I mean, that's unimpeachable song.
So if somebody's never heard prog before, they're skeptical. you put this one on, I think you could do a lot worse. This has always been a bop. And it's pretty short, too. It's like 3.5 minutes.
Not the worst starting place, for sure.
All right, let's do it up, boys. Oh, come on. Beatles-y,
yeah.
Now that I'm hearing it here.
Wow, yeah.
Oh, bringing that early motif back in. This would be so hard to play.
I don't know why, but this is like really hitting the spot for me right now.
Me too,
it's
man.
It's fucking great.
The bass being so upfront. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Such a killer mix.
What the lyrics are doing.
Doesn't matter.
Don't matter. All right.
We could just hang out, listen to that all day. Oh, man.
Yes, we
it's
could.
It's been so long since I listened to Yes, especially like a Yes hit, like not driving and accidentally hearing it on Q104.3. You know what I mean? And I will not turn it off. If it comes on, I'll enjoy it. But I've not sat with headphones. And Adam, I feel like you probably feel the same way. Like I've not sat with headphones and like listened to Fragile. Maybe ever. But it's amazing.
Should do it.
It's probably been since I was a teenager, honestly. I mean, and it just sounds so fresh and so, you know, it holds up real well.
Mm.
I think that mix is very forward thinking, you know, like having the totally. The bass being like sort of the main like driving instrument there. It's like what Joy Division does too, where, you know, that's where all the catchy, cool shit is happening. The guitar is sort of decorating it all up top. Ah, man, it's a great fucking record.
You're here. Hopefully I'll be able to keep up this level
of quality,
of enthusiasm throughout. We're starting strong here, no doubt about it.
Next is Vandegraaff Generator.
next is Genesis.
Okay.
I'm a little fuzzier on Genesis. I think, like, different periods, it's a different lead singer, they're really prolific, they have like an 80s pop period I'm not as into as much, although you could totally say the same about Yes.
Yeah.
Where I've landed, partially through the help of Niagara Moon fan Joe, shout out to Joe. We talked about this on previous installment of this podcast. We talked about the Genesis album Duke from 1980.
You know, I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah, I can't say. I mean, I know some of the big hits, but...
So it's Phil Collins era,
oh.
But it's like early on in that. And they still have a lot of more proggy experimental leanings. Post-divorce, Phil Collins is my favorite Phil Collins. Great vocal performances up and down this album.
Pre-Tarzan.
Hey, Tarzan's pretty good too.
Big time marker there for him.
Yeah.
So this album, Duke, I would also recommend this to like a curious, someone curious about prog. Also offer this one up.
Prog curious.
I'm prog curious. I mean, it's this isn't going to top Long Distance Runaround necessarily, but...
No, I'm feeling like it's not already.
I'll share a song from Duke. It's actually called Duchess. This one is very anthemic. This always is a banger for me. Definitely a lot simpler rhythmically, and I think you're going to pretty much see that with every other song I play here today, but still counts as prog. You can still call it prog. Doesn't have to be fiddly with the time signatures.
Okay. Is this record not going past the point where Genesis were considered prog. Like, when I think of prog Genesis, I think of Peter Gabriel, who was long exited.
This is still a prog album, especially, like, right from the opening track. I'm forgetting what it's called off the top of my head. But you hear, like, 30 seconds of that, and you're like, this is progressive rock. I don't know what else to call this. Like, it has poppy elements that come in, but it's still, like, it's way too dynamic with the arrangement and with the rhythm to be anything else. So by the time you get, like, into 83, 85, it's like, yeah, it gets murky, and they're kind of just 80s pop, and then you get into Sussudio and all that other shit. Sure. But this is right before all that.
Okay. All right.
I dig this tune, and it's long, and I'm going to skip to, like, you know, 2 minutes in so we can get to the catchy part.
Bring it on.
Let's do it.
We'll see if you guys like this.
Okay.
I'm curious.
This album also has Must Be Some Misunderstanding. Do you guys know that one?
Yeah.
Great song.
I was actually just listening to Peter Gabriel with my two-year-old because she wanted to see Sledgehammer, which is an incredible video. She liked the part where the chickens were dancing, which I agree. I like it too.
Yeah, it's a good, very good. I'm on the same page as your daughter most of the time.
Samesies. All right, so let's get into this tune, Duchess by Genesis, 1980. See if you guys dig this at all. This is after, like, some moody electronics, drum machine beat going on, and then we kick into this part here. Prog, right? We're all but a few away the you guys don't like this one, I can tell.
Sort of split on it.
I don't dislike it. I think it's a well-written song. I don't know that it's prog, though.
It's prog!
Yeah, the prog elements are pretty obvious.
Too many synthesizer parts for it not to be prog.
It almost has like a, sounds like it was written for an 80s soundtrack to like a teen drama.
Alright, I like that.
You know, I don't know. Something about it isn't clicking with me, but I can appreciate it for what it is. It doesn't hit me as much as something that you could point to and say, this is what progressive rock is. It's so pop oriented.
That's true.
You know what I mean? There are prog things about it, but they're very subtle.
Yeah.
And I think that's why Genesis became so popular in the 80s, is because those tendencies of theirs from the 70s were made a lot more subtle and, you know.
Yeah. Curtailed a lot of that.
Yeah. It's okay, you know?
Yeah, it's, well, again, somebody who hates prog, quote unquote, or thinks they hate prog.
Yeah.
I think that's a decent enough olive branch there. Hey, prog can be this. This is still considered prog. And it's not, you know?
Yeah, and at the very least, it'll bring them to more Genesis, which...
Sure.
Yeah, because their early stuff is pretty wild.
Pretty out there?
It's pretty wild, yeah. British people love it. British people fucking love Genesis.
That should be the name of this episode.
Whenever I meet a British person, the first thing they talk about
is Genesis.
Then you do name introduction, where you're from.
Yeah.
Are you going to talk about King Crimson at all? I'm imagining.
Yeah,
that
I'm
going to
talk about fucking King Crimson. Okay. You know I am.
Sure.
You knew that was coming next.
But which King Crimson?
In the court of the Crimson King. Come on, guys.
Yeah, I figured he was
not overthinking this here.
I thought you were going to go with the Adrian Belew talking heads played by Primus King Crimson.
I haven't gotten into that stuff so much. I stick with the classic, you know?
There was a whole episode that I wrote on the album Red, and then decided that he was just going to hate it too much, so I couldn't even bring it in. There was just not going to be a point in bringing it, so I just scrapped it. But I did try to bring in Red at one point. I was thinking about it.
Do you like the Talking Heads? I assume.
Love Talking Heads. Love Talking Heads. Adrian Belew, I'm on board. I love his solo on Born Under Punches. I'm all ears.
And how do you feel about Primus?
I don't like Primus. Too goofy.
Well, they're somewhere in between those two bands for sure. They have like a lot of that very loud, slappy Chapman stick bass.
Yeah, what about Tony Levin playing a Chapman stick? Do you want to see that?
Oh my God.
I like Chapman sticks sometimes. I don't know about Chapman stick bass, but.
Do you like Chapman sticks for 8 songs in a row?
I remember there was a guy.
I'll try it out.
There's a guy I used to know through a friend, and I had to spend a 6-hour day with him at one time, some work situation. And he spent like 4 of those 6 hours showing me Tony Levin playing Chapman stick song.
I thought you were going to say that he played it for you.
No, that would have been better. It was just watching Tony Levin stomp around on stage with the Chapman stick.
He does stomp. He stomps
around. Yeah.
Yeah. In concert with Peter Gabriel, they like both have like a choreographed movement.
Stomp.
With the
stomp session.
I'm sticking with the fundamentals. This is like everybody who considers himself a prog fan, surely you started here, and surely you have opinions, I would assume, mostly positive. You know, this is 101.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to listen to The Court of the Crimson King, that track in particular.
Please do.
Gave me goosebumps when it popped up on Children of Men. I don't know if you guys know that movie.
Yeah.
Just a classic, heavy tune.
Oh, absolutely. And there are elements of this that are going to be pertinent to what I'm bringing to the table.
Oh,
it's not progressive rock, something that's very prominent in this. So,
all right.
Wow, that's a real brain teaser. I'm thinking about that. What could it be?
Yeah, let's do it here. King Crimson, 1969. This is just, you can't fuck with this song. Greg Lake's got a good voice.
The purple piper plays his tune, the choir softly sing. 3 lullabies in an ancient tongue for the court of the crimson.
Yeah, pretty good drumming.
Yeah, what else is there like this?
Yeah.
The keeper of the city keys put shutters on the dreams. I wait outside.
All right, so the song does go on for 10 minutes.
Yeah,
worth every penny.
It's worth it. I will admit, I'm a little embarrassed to admit, there was a section maybe 5 minutes in. I think it got very floaty for a while, and I was like, am I getting bored? Do I want to fast forward? And then it kept going and locked in, and I was all good. But that's what I mean about being a fair-weather prog fan. I get really impatient sometimes.
Isn't that part of it?
There's a couple moments like that in the album.
Yeah.
Most of that album is killer from start to finish. There's a couple of minutes, I could see a like a, you know, someone who isn't into the genre being like, what's going on? But, you know, for me, the whole thing is A plus from side A to side B. It's incredible.
Yeah. Hmm. There was a time where I really religiously listened to like Lark's Tongue and Aspic and Starless and Bible Black and just like heavily into them. I think the less of a social life I had, the more I listened to those records.
There's like a Venn
close
diagram.
Correlation. I was never more into Prague than when I had less human interaction.
I gotta say though, this album was so important for me. It was my window into Brian Eno.
Oh yeah.
And you know, because the Fripp and Eno record, I wanted to hear everything by Robert Fripp, and then the Eno thing, and then Eno got me into all the things that he was producing. And you know, there's so many like branches that come off of this. Mm-hmm. This album I think is such a great starting point for somebody who's even mildly interested in really out there music, you know, because I love fucking crazy ass weird music, and this is like it kicked me off. I was in such like a sort of classic rock kind of a straight and narrow path until I heard this. And the album cover, that face screaming. How could you not want to listen to that?
Album covers are great for all these albums. Yeah. Like, prog rock always nails the album cover.
Gentle Giant's got my favorite. With the giant.
With the giant's face?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, it kind of looks like a Cabbage Patch Kid also.
Yeah. They use it for more than one album, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
All right, fellas. I got one last pick here. I'm very enthusiastic about this last song. Unlike In the Court of the Crimson King, this song, it captivates me the whole way through. It's like 12 minutes long. I'm along for the whole ride. I would argue the song is progressive rock. I don't know why it can't be. I don't know why. If you want to tell me otherwise, you make a convincing argument. The only difference about this song is the time it was recorded in. If it was from the 70s, it'd be no question. For some reason, I feel like I have to make an argument for it being a prog rock song. I know Thin Lear loves this song. I'm guessing Adam does as well. This is like, it's so good. All right, guys, it's Siberian Breaks by MGMT from the album Congratulations, 2010.
Yeah, this is, I really like this song, but I don't think that it's prog. I think it's like art pop.
What the?
Yeah. Well, I don't know what to call MGMT. I'm sure there's a name.
MGMT has plenty of songs that have nothing to do with prog rock. This one, though, it's a 12-minute fucking epic. It's got 8 different sections. It changes up the time. It's got epic orchestration, different arrangement. Like, it's progressive rock. It's rock that is progressive.
Is it nerdy enough, though?
I'll allow it.
Well, let's listen to it. But yeah, I don't know.
This song, just from day one, I was like, oh, MGMT made this? Like, this is a masterpiece. Like, I feel like our generation has yet to recognize this as like the Bohemian Rhapsody for millennials.
Oh my God. These are gigantic statements that are being made right here.
I had that thought, and then I went on YouTube, and that was like one of the top comments. And I'm like, they get it. People are connecting here. I think this is a prog song. I think this would be a very enticing advertisement for prog rock. Siberian Breaks by MGMT.
Past the goal, the bridge that
great tune. It goes on for 10 more minutes. There's peaks, there's valleys. It gets really intense. Multiple different sections that glue together. Masterpiece of progressive rock.
I think it's a great
my case.
Song. That is, I think, the best album that they've made. I don't know why people didn't dig that album so much when it came out. I think maybe because it was like less poppy than the first one.
It was
one.
Not Kids in Time to Pretend.
Right, right. But I think that's like the most solid collection of songs they have. It's really, really yes. excellent. But I do not think that is prog music.
It doesn't come off as obvious prog, the same thing that sort of happened with the Genesis. It's kind of like low-key in its progressive leanings.
It gets weirder. We played like one of the more normal sections
right.
of this 12-minute song. Yeah.
And they're great musicians, but like, isn't prog also about like this virtuoso musicianship? Like not just good, but like, isn't that a part of it? Isn't that a staple of it? Like the classic prog bands?
Does it have to be? Is that in the Wikipedia definition? I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I think it's come to be like, I think there are prog purists out there who will only listen to stuff that is played like Dream Theater kind of stuff where it's all technical show pieces.
Not every single Dream Theater song is that way, though, I feel like, when your buddy Mike showed us some tunes.
Yeah, but he was trying to show you the ones to get you into it. He wasn't like...
He was luring you in with...
Yeah.
Yeah, but I feel like 99% of Dream Theater's output is very technically showy. And then they have like 1% of stuff that they, you know, I think most bands want to have some kind of entry point that isn't as alienating as the rest of their stuff. I've seen them live. It was exhausting.
Me too. I had a great time though. I had a great time. I wished that I was more of a fan.
But it's like exercising, you know? There's just... It was like being hit. I didn't hate it, but besides them, but bands like that, I think there are purists out there who need it to have all of those elements constantly. But bands like Queen. Queen is a progressive band. They don't...
Queen,
you know...
Queen totally has prog rock albums, yeah. Their early stuff.
Yeah, and they're not doing things that are necessarily considered, like... totally by the book dogmatic prog rock stuff, you know. Obviously something like Bohemian Rhapsody with those like harmonies and the changes and stuff. What else do you call that?
Yeah
art pop, apparently.
Art pop.
Well, I mean, MGMT, I think we can all agree, besides Thomas, is not, it's not prog.
I'm not gonna say MGMT is a prog band, like that's maybe not one of the top three adjectives. But Siberian Breaks is kind of a prog song. Isn't
well,
that like
be
a
prog elements, but this is your introduction to the genre. Like I was thinking it was going to be like, I feel like you're 2 for 2 on this. I think King Crimson song. Yes. Songs like those are absolutely okay, perfect.
Okay. I love how hard of a line you're taking. Yeah.
Somebody's gotta. Well, in the spirit of the genre itself, my segment has gotten overly long and self-indulgent. So I think I am going to finally hand it off to Adam here.
Yeah.
But Adam, what have you been listening to this week?
Losing my opinion.
Well, I'm going to answer a question with a question.
All right.
How familiar are you with the song poem industry?
What? Song poem industry.
What were those three words together?
It's the song poem industry. Around like 2003, a documentary came out called Off the Charts, and it was about this thing called the song poem industry. And it, I mean, this goes back to early 20th century. The more commonly known form of it started in like the 50s and 60s and 70s. There'd be these ads in the back of comic books and like magazines and, you know, newspapers soliciting poems. And what they would ask for was, hey, send us your lyrics. We're looking for lyrics for songs that could be shopped to record labels. We need hit songwriters. We're always looking for them. Send us your lyrics and we'll tell you if we think they're good enough to make a song with. And the scam here is that everybody was always good enough. Everybody who sent in lyrics would get a form back saying like, oh my God, these are the greatest lyrics I've ever seen. send us $300 and we'll make this into a song in the style of your choosing. We'll shop it and we'll try to get it out there into record stores and on the charts, and you'll be a star. That's what I've been getting reacquainted with in the last week. All these thousands and I haven't listened to thousands of those, but there are thousands and thousands of these things from the last 50 years that are absolutely insane. And it's like this fascinating meeting point where like some like cold, cynical, calculated commerce is met with like unpretentious, open-hearted, unrestrained artistic ambition. And there's like, you know, you see that in like outsider artists, well-known outsider artists like Tiny Tim or Beefheart, the Shags, and Wildman Fisher. But this is a totally different thing. And
this sounds wild.
Yeah, you know, there's not all of them are interesting. Not all of them are good, but, you know, because most of them are bad, in fact. But, you know, these are people who really wanted and really felt like this could be their break into the industry. Oh, there he is. That's Gary. That's Gary Forney, song poet and rock and roller in his own right. Let's see here.
I have a couple of questions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Please.
All right. My first question of many is, I guess, one, I love this. It's not a question, but this is great. I love that we're doing this. It's just the right amount of insanity, absurd stuff, and also like this melodrama involved, because like people are getting conned here and there is artistic ambition. Yeah, and
I see why there is a documentary.
Yeah, there's hopes on the line here. Like it's kind of devastating to realize the con, I think, if you were, you know, buying into it. When was this peaking? Like when was like the height of this industry? Because I don't believe you could do this now, right?
Now it's a lot different. I mean, now there you have AI apps that can do it for you. There are people that just plainly say, "I'll put your words to music." They don't need the con, you know, because people just want that. And there's also, you know, you have all kinds of tools at your disposal. So it's, yeah, the industry's kind of died out. The peak for it, you know, in the early 20th century, you would send in your lyrics and they'd put it on sheet music and they'd send it back to you. It's not as exciting, but
it's been a con for a long time, but
for a very long time. They call it song sharking.
These particular recordings that we're going to hear today, are we talking like 90s?
They span from about the 60s through the 80s. You know, the lyricists sometimes have talent. The more interesting things that have come out of this really niche subgenre have been artists like Rod Keith, who I'm going to feature prominently today. He was a jazz musician who had ambitions as a composer. And because of money issues and drug addiction, fell into this industry where he could turn over a lot of music very fast. You know, they'd do these things. They'd sight read the lyrics and be making the music in one take.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So it sounds like a fucking disaster, but actually he transcends this to such a degree. And well, I'm gonna get into him. I want to give you a taste of the more bizarre kind of shit that comes from this, and from one of my favorite songs. And tell me if you've heard this one.
I'm sure I haven't. So we're calling it a con, and I totally understand why. But
yeah,
at the end of the day, you submit lyrics, you do get to receive a song that was made for you. Like, you got something for your $300, it sounds like.
You get a 45. In the 50s and 60s, you get a 45, and they'd send you fake charts, like showing you.
Sure, a lot of deception involved. Unlike the real record industry, there was none of that.
Mm-hmm. All above board.
But there were musicians in a room and there was a studio engineer.
Absolutely. Yes, you were getting something for your money. And it might have been, I mean, that's $300 in the 50s or 60s.
A lot of money.
That's a ton of money. So you do it in installments. And this one I'm sending is from the 80s or 90s, I believe. It's somewhere in there. And this is more of like drum machine. This is what the industry became eventually, which is David Fox is the name of the artist. I don't think that's his real name. In the film, in the documentary, there is a demonstration of him making one of these. He gets the letter, he gets the lyrics, and he's done within like 45 minutes from first reading the lyrics to doing the drums, to doing everything, to his vocals. It's pretty fascinating. But this is one that has been memed a little bit on the internet. Okay. It's called Nonviolent Taekwondo Warriors.
Wow, I can't wait to hear it.
Is Matt Farley listening to this being like, wouldn't take me 45 minutes?
I feel like, yeah, Matt Farley would have been amazing at this.
Yeah, he'd certainly put love into it.
It's something I really wanted to do after I saw this documentary, but it's just, you know.
I'm very confused at what I'm looking at. The band, quote unquote, is called Nonviolent Taekwondo Troopers.
That is the name of the song.
That's the name of the song, okay.
The artist is Skaglar Singletary, and the person who actually recorded it is David Fox, a.k.a. I think Arthur Kaufman.
And who's Angelaria? Oh, that's the name of the song?
Angelaria. That's the chorus of the song.
Okay.
I don't know why they put that there.
All right. So Nonviolent Taekwondo Troopers is the name of the song by Kagler Juan Singletary. Okay. This is all coming together. And you said this is from the 60s?
No, this one I think is
80s.
Is late 80s, early 90s, somewhere about.
I can't. This is going
to
be insane.
Very excited to hear.
Denler. What the hell are we getting ourselves into?
Yeah, I have no idea what this is.
Within Queen City of Southern Tears, I am sitting on my super bicycle and Angelaria, and I'm dressed like Captain Bicycle.
Not bad.
Although my evil twin brother Tiger on a warm summer day destroyed original Angelaria. Ones like a cyborg. Angelaria, show me yourself. Come and live a spirit, Jesus Christ. Thank Jehovah for Kung Fu Bicycles and Priscilla Presley.
What the fuck is going on?
Priscilla Presley.
But this has to be a joke, right?
No. This is deadly serious.
Angelaria, there's something there. That's catchy.
Yeah.
Come to Papa.
I mean, this could be a lot worse. This is kind of legit.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
I just love a bicycle.
Yeah, no, that's extremely enjoyable to listen to.
Angelaria.
Yeah. I mean, there are whole YouTube channels now that just, they make songs like that, obviously trying to be absurd and funny.
Yeah. The thing about Kaglar is that he's in the documentary. He talks about, you know, he's with his aunt or his grandmother or something who, I'm not sure he's 100% there, you know, like he's a very odd character.
Sure.
With a lot of odd obsessions, like guns and Jesus and Kung Fu and Annie Oakley and
Priscilla. It's a lot.
Yeah, so
juggling a lot there. Yeah.
Yeah, so that it's kind of all stuck in. It comes to this like beautiful blend of seemingly non sequiturs. I assume it makes sense to him.
Sure.
it's extremely enjoyable.
So any questions about
No, I think that was great. That was
Can
lovely.
We hear like five more?
Absolutely. I wanted to play you one other one that's sort of on the crazy side before I got into the stuff that I find to be incredibly beautiful. This is called The Human Breakdown of Absurdity. And let me just note these are 100% sincere. There are ones that are obviously a joke. I am not featuring them. Like, there's a famous one by John Truby called Blind Man's Penis.
Classic.
Okay.
I encourage listeners to go seek it out. It's a fun song. But I think he was one of the first people to really figure out that this was bullshit.
Right.
And used it as a way to try to get these, to see if they would say the most offensive shit possible. And so it's a pretty fun and funny song. I just wanted to feature some things that I think are 100% dead serious.
Sure. Right.
So this one, I'm not sure who wrote it, but it's featured in the introduction of the documentary. And I think it could have been a psychedelic on like a Nuggets compilation or something.
Ooh, now you got Matt's attention.
Love that. Love Nuggets.
Very cool guitar intro.
All right. So we're going to hear Norm Burns' Human Breakdown of Absurdity. That's a very attention-grabbing title. This is fairly long, too. These aren't just like minute-and-a-half long goof-offs. Like, this song we're about to play is like almost 4.5 minutes. That's legit, you know?
Oh, yeah, they weren't fucking around. These guys were hardcore session musicians.
Wow. They filled coins in the fortune fountain, searching for a place in the mountain where the sexless virgins could moan, watched by clergymen with faces of stone. Under the law of human absurdity.
Matt's doing some gnarly air guitar.
Crying women of Jerusalem are empty of tears when the bloodthirsty hunters killing their bears to satisfy their hunger for blood, to make the world know that everything good be better for human absurdity.
One of the top comments is, all these songs are the definition of they really didn't need to go that hard.
Agreed.
And undertakers refuse to dig, and when cocksure heroes massacre.
The guitar's a little indulgent, but like,
no, it's pretty understated.
This is radio ready otherwise.
The power of human absurdity.
That guitar is definitely done in one take.
Wow.
I love that.
That one is super. I can listen to that all day.
It's a couple things I love about it. One, the guitar. I love how little regard the guitarist has for the vocals. It's like almost
he's
as
just
if
playing.
He just doesn't give a shit about what the singer is doing. The other part of it is like, it's what's becoming apparent is, and this is the same in the last one too, like these musicians were getting like a page and a half of lyrics. You know, like you hear them struggling to fit.
How do we fit it all in?
These lyrics in, and like, okay, how do we jam another stanza into this verse?
Could you imagine getting these lyrics sat down in front of you and having to fit them in?
And, you know, it's not rhyming, and it's just, like, this story.
Crazy phrases. So many words.
Yeah, words that don't really... Not that... I shouldn't say they don't belong in a song, because any word could work in a song, but, you know, like, there are some words that melodically fit and other words that don't.
They're not intended for songs.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's... In the documentary, they talk. They don't read the lyrics. You know what I mean? They don't read them. They sing them. They sight sing them. So sometimes they'll say, like, I don't realize what I'm saying. And when I finally do, it's too late. I have to stop myself from laughing because it's so crazy sometimes, you know. I imagine that some of these people must have been lunatics. You know, like the sexless virgins did moan and all that,
that
stuff.
That could just be some imagery from their Christian upbringing. You didn't, you know, we don't know what's going on here 50 years ago, 60 years ago.
That's true. I shouldn't judge the song poets.
Yeah, those lyrics sound completely on the level to me.
Adam, how many of these have you listened to?
I don't know. Hundreds.
Hundreds.
Yeah, most of them are terrible, though. Like,
where you said a lot of them weren't online. Where are you getting the stash here?
This is the soundtrack to the movie. Off the charts.
That's a big old vinyl.
My girlfriend got this for me for Christmas. She's a very,
love it.
Very sweet person.
That's a heck of a gift.
It has a lot of the harder to find ones that are featured in the movie. That one's on it. And then this, years ago, Tom Ardolino from NRBQ was kind of like the first guy to dig these up and start putting them into the public. And he released this, I think, in the 90s. It's called Beat of the Traps, MSR Madness Volume 1. And if any of the listeners out there are interested, WFMU re-hosted, because there's a website called the American Song Poem, whatever it is. I don't know. But that website used to host a ton of song poems. So if you just Google WFMU song poems, there is a treasure trove, volumes upon volumes of them. There are also a lot of collectors out there. Penn Jillette is a huge collector of these.
Oh, not kidding.
That makes sense. Yeah.
He says he has a couple terabytes worth of digital song poems. So there are resources, and there's plenty on YouTube nowadays. But back in the day, it was, you know, there was just a few collections. And what I'm going to move on to is the guy, which is Rod Keith. And the thing that is similar to King Crimson is that for some of these songs, he used exclusively a Mellotron for every single instrument.
Oh, shit.
So the sound on them is like, it sounds like nothing else in the whole world. And before I gush about Rod Keith, I'm just going to play you a track of his, and you guys can tell me what you think. So this one is called Little Rug Bug.
Little Rug Bug.
Yes.
This is late 60s? What are we talking here?
Yeah, yeah, this is certainly late 60s.
It's a dapper-looking gentleman here on the thumbnail. Kind of looks like Frank Sinatra almost.
He's a good-looking guy.
All right. I cannot wait to hear this.
Laying on the floor, someone I adore, creeping and crawling, going to explore.
About a dog, an infant?
It's about a rug bug, dog.
Maybe a baby.
At least this person isn't using so many different words. It's nice.
Yeah. It's tight.
Like hypnotic.
Yeah, it kind of feels like the song could go on for a half hour.
Yeah. Super psychedelic.
This is a wild solo. This is a crazy song. That's an insane song because on one level, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
And then on another level, it is like strangely hypnotic and beautiful. Like his changes. Obviously, the lyrics are not helping. He's got an albatross with those lyrics. Like he has to try to turn that into something listenable. So it's almost like you're starting with minus in this situation because you got a little rug bug in front of you. You have to turn it into something listenable. So he does that, which is like, it's just such a strange thing to start off with a weight when you're having to deliver a song. Like what other songwriter is doing that? who's writing their own material is just not happening. So I'm just very impressed by it that he was able to take those lyrics and turn them into something that is, beautiful.
Yeah, that's what becomes like the art of song poems, is these sort of banal, you know, this is obviously, I think, just about a baby that someone thought was cute.
A little red bird.
And they just wanted a song. Mm-hmm. And then they send their $300 in, and they get back this like haunting, beautiful, psychedelic, like sort of eerie sounding. I mean, in my opinion, a masterpiece. Like, this is gorgeous shit. And the fact that it came from this genre. That's
such a weird context.
Yeah. Really, really odd.
Do you think they even liked it?
No.
Like, they probably were expecting.
No.
They probably were expecting, like, some, you know,
something
really.
With finger snaps. And
yeah. Like, lightweight.
Barbershop thing. Quartet.
Yeah. I think this was way out there for the time, for sure. And what they got it back, you know, they probably played it a few times and like, oh, you know, that's the song I made. The fact that it has a life at all beyond its original use is sort of incredible.
that somebody found
this, you know, years later.
And now it's on a podcast.
And now it's on a podcast. That's where
the ultimate arbiter of, yeah, whether something is good or not. Yeah, that's a special song. I will definitely be listening to that again. Like, it's already in my head.
Should play that for Alma.
Yeah, I'm sure she'd love it.
I've spent many a night listening to Rod and his like
singing about rug
crazy music. You want to hear another one?
Definitely.
Let's do one more. Yeah.
Yeah.
Here, I'm gonna give you Ecstasy to Frenzy, and this one I think it must be about a psychedelic experience.
Ecstasy to Frenzy.
Or extreme mental illness. It has to be one of the two.
Sure, it's one or the other. Right.
I had two others. I want to play out on another one. So here, I'm going to send this, and yeah, Ecstasy to Frenzy.
It's going to be the title of my autobiography. Is this also Rod Keith?
This is also Rod. Rod Keith. He's had a lot of names. Rod Rogers, Rod Keith. Sometimes he's just credited as Rod.
Where is he from, Rod Keith?
Somewhere in the middle of the country, but he ended up in L.A. and he was playing jazz. His son's an avant-garde jazz musician, and he's also sort of instrumental in discovering a lot of these. His name's Ellery Eskelin. And Rod Keith, you know, he was sort of on the periphery of the industry, just playing a lot of club dates and stuff. And he fell into this work and also into drugs. And it's a very sad story. He ends up committing suicide by jumping off of the Hollywood freeway.
Okay.
And this was something he had described as prostitution. He hated making song poems. So that's like another sort of angle to this that's sort of like adds to the beauty of it, that he hated this, but he made these really gorgeous songs. I don't know, I'm gushing too much. That's just
you can hear it. You can hear what's working against this artist. That's what I was trying to describe before, is like you hear him working against something, and yet he is this triumph in spite of that. That's what I hear in that last song.
Yeah, it comes through in a lot of his tunes too.
All right, Ecstasy to Frenzy, Rod Keith. My brain is all scrambled now. Sounds like Beach Boys.
I'm searching for a way, and my eyes are blind with colors. I can't believe what I feel. Can this trip be real? I'm searching for a way. Yes, I'm searching for a new life. Perhaps the world's a cube or a tunnel.
We're getting into time cube stuff here.
That's why I'm searching.
I'm searching for the truth.
This is probably my favorite one so far.
This is great. Listen to that instrumentation.
Oh, absolutely. According to the documentary, this guy did it all himself, too.
Man in his Mellotron.
I'm searching for a way, having fantastic sensation. Ecstasy to frenzy, now my eyes are colorblind. Ecstasy to frenzy, this is what I find. To frenzy. This is what I find.
That background thing.
That background vocal. He didn't have to go that hard.
Jesus. Da-da-da-da-da.
Will we just listen to that whole thing?
Yeah, man. Oh, I mean, shit. There's so, like, this guy could be like Robert Wyatt. You know, if he's not working with these fucking song poems, he totally has that talent to be able to make outsider pop.
Yeah, he was around in the late 60s and early 70s. I don't understand why he wasn't in, like, a more contemporary band or working with more contemporary artists and stuck doing this. He was in L.A. There was so much going on. It is a tragedy that, you know, his life ended up that way, but he left a lot, like a crazy legacy that nobody expected.
And no one will ever have again. Yeah, you know, like,
no.
he's got, you know, for better or worse, there is no musician like him.
No, absolutely not. And there's two tracks on one of his compilations that his son put together that are more of his, like, they're sort of like these avant-garde Terry Riley-esque pieces that are organs played at like backwards and forwards at the same time with a lot of very like strange vocals and sounds and stuff. And it's like a sort of window into what could have been had he, you know, gotten the chance to do what he wanted.
Is there any like evidence of his own? So, like, does he have any songs that are 100% his?
No.
Just all song
poems? To my knowledge, the bulk of, besides those two, and they're half-hour tracks, they're pretty long. Besides those two pieces, I don't think there's anything else that is available to the public besides the song poems. And there are a lot of song poems. You go on Discogs, you see ones that I've never heard of popping up all the time.
When you say a lot, what do you mean?
I mean thousands.
From him?
From him alone.
From just
yeah.
him.
Like I'm going to take a guess. He did this for years, you know?
Yeah,
and they were doing multiple songs a day.
Yeah, that'll add up. Matt Farley will tell you that.
So, you know, I'm pretty confident in saying there's probably 1,000 Rod Keith song poems.
Wow.
You know? It's something that I've been obsessed with for a long time.
thank you for sharing this with us. This is rocking my world today.
This is wonderful. Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. Thanks for having me back on, guys. I loved it so much.
This is fucking great. So obviously we learned about...
I learned more...
The wonder of song poems.
Wonder
the song
poems.
Poem industry, as it were.
It's such a crazy... I got to watch... What's the documentary called?
Off the Charts.
Off the Charts, yeah. Gotta watch that.
Yeah, you have to. Everybody's gotta watch. It's one of the best documentaries ever. It's so funny. It's so, like, emotional and interesting. You know, you learn...
So many characters involved.
Yeah. That guy that you could see, that's Gary Forney. He transitioned from song poem artist to started making music on his own. And he's released some stuff on a record label in Connecticut that Color Book actually released stuff on.
Oh, so, hello, bringing it back around.
Yeah, TPOS.
And you tripped Bill Bruford in a club one time.
Yeah, those are my stories. Let me tell those to the day I die.
I'm just sort of blown away by the whole concept of it. And then Rod Keith, that story is amazing. What an artist. Yeah, it's hard to think of a musician that is so burdened by the music itself and having to make it of quality.
Yeah.
Like starting at a deficit. It's just, it's such a strange concept.
Being able to make music of that quality despite yourself, like, I don't think I could do it, honestly. I think anything that would come out of me would be so contrived and just uninteresting, which a lot of song poems are pretty uninteresting. But then you have guys like Rod. There are others, too. Gene Marshall and Dick Kent and stuff can do stuff like that. But Rod is the guy, you know.
Well, this is shaping up to be our longest episode to date.
Longer than the goddamn... than the last one I was on?
In the spirit of prog rock, this is a long episode today. This is very exciting stuff here that we dug into. Does anybody have anything they want to plug? Anything coming up?
Ouija has just been featured on this compilation, the Dot Dash Mixtape Volume 2. Ooh. It's international artists all over the world on Dot Dash Sounds, which will also be releasing our album Primitive Thrill on vinyl in the fall.
Whoa.
And we're going to be playing at Scorpion Records in Queens next on June 15th.
Cool.
A Beach of Nightly Glory, the new Thin Lyra EP, is coming out on June 7th. So 2 days from now. Very excited. Coming out via MGM. I'm very excited to be working with them. Thank you for releasing my EP. It's a pleasure working with Matthew E. White. He produced this. And yeah, listen to it and enjoy it. Thank you for listening to the single so far. We got one more single that just came out on June 3rd. You can listen to that. We have a piece up on the Talk House. It's an essay I wrote about being a songwriter and a dad, which is, I think, 90% of my personality now, more and more every day. So you can read that essay if you'd like and listen to the new single. And yeah, EP is out on Friday.
Hell yeah. And it came out a little while ago now, but it's still fresh. Check out Niagara Moon's latest album, Rebuild the Circus, after you're done with Beach Nightly Glory.
Hey, you can listen in whatever order you want.
I mean, obviously you want to listen to my album first, but if you can make time later, fit in the old Thin Lyra's EP there.
If you got time.
They pair well together.
Right.
Just like two co-hosts on a podcast, you might say. All right. Well, if people aren't cringing too hard, make sure to subscribe to Losing My Opinion so you never miss a future episode. You can follow Losing My Opinion on Instagram, TikTok, or let's all do it together, guys.
X.
We're on X. I don't know how much longer, but we're on.
Yeah, as long as it's up there.
And God damn it, Siberian Breaks is a prog rock song. Prog rock masterpiece. And I could be wrong now.
But I don't think so.
Yeah, I think you're wrong.
I was going to say, can we go out on this other track? Beat of the Traps.
Yes.
You want to play us out?
Yeah, we'll play us. We've never been played out, but let's be played out.
All right.
Let's do it live.
We'll do it live. I'll say so long, suckers. We'll see you next week.
Everybody, go watch Off the Charts. It'll be your favorite documentary. And yeah, thanks for having me on, guys.
Beat, the core, the very heart, the place where rhythm has its start, the